clerk will call the docket. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Wiley Latham, and I represent Arletha Sims in this matter. On November 4th, 2010, Arletha Sims arrived at the United States Post Office in Emporia, Virginia. She parked her car illegally, got out of the vehicle, and attempted to proceed into the post office. As she was crossing the parking lot, she was injured when John Van Son backed out of a parking space and hit her with his vehicle. As a result of that collision, she suffered injury and brought suit for personal injury in the Circuit Court of Brunswick County. And that case was tried on October 6, 2014, with the Honorable W. Allen Sherritt presiding. At the end of the plaintiff's case, appellees made a motion to strike the evidence on the grounds that Arletha Sims was contributory negligence a matter of law, and said negligence was the proximate cause of the incident sued upon. Thus, I'm here today on behalf of Arletha Sims on appeal that the trial court was in error in sustaining their motion. The crux of the defendant's argument for contributory negligence and the proximate cause is heavily based off of the fact that the definition of highway falls on the post office parking lot because it's federal, it's United States government. It's property controlled by the United States government. In doing, as a result, the appellees applied 46.2-923 and 46.2-928, which are rules that statute that essentially direct and control how pedestrians are supposed to traverse roadways. Contrary to what the defendants assert, the facts and circumstances of this case are not as black and white as they would have you believe. However, the fact that the post office is a parking lot by statute, but configured in its primary use as a parking lot, creates a quandary that requires a detailed analysis of the facts and a common sense application of the law. In considering Arletha Sims' conduct before she was hit, the primary use of the location, and her prior experience in the parking lot, reasonable minds could differ as to whether Sims was negligent, and especially as to whether said negligence was the proximate cause of the incident.
So your whole point, counsel, is that there are highways and there are highways. There's I-95 and then there's this parking lot.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And jurors are representing society at large, making those judgment calls and distinguishing between one and the other, and they should have had a chance to do that here.
That is correct, Your Honor. I mean, it's justice. That is correct. Okay? It is well established in this Commonwealth that the issue of contributory negligence proximate cause are better fit for the jury, are best left to jury determination. And Rasher v. Friend, this court established the trial court should overrule a motion to strike the evidence in every case in which there is any doubt that the party with the burden to do so has failed to prove negligence, contributory negligence, and proximate cause, as the case may be. The rule avoids the delay and expense to the parties when a plaintiff is successful on appeal and a new trial is required. If the court overrules the motion to strike, submits the case to the jury, and the plaintiff's verdict is returned, the court may set the verdict aside as being contrary to the evidence or without evidence to support it. If the court reaches a different conclusion upon appeal, the record includes the verdict, and we can enter a final judgment, thus ending the case. As with questions of negligence, whether an act was approximate cause of an event is best determined by the jury. This is so simply because the particular facts of each case are so critical to that determination.
May I interrupt you again?
Yes.
If you go to the jury in a case like this, how would you tailor the jury instructions to take into account that there are statutory provisions that define highways, and as the defense has pointed out, there are recognized principles of law that govern the degree of reasonable care?
I think you'd have to tailor the jury instruction. It would be more so the argument that you'd make once the jury instruction is submitted. The jury instruction may be tailored to include the fact that the to include an indicator as to the configuration of the parking lot, to explain that this is a horseshoe-shaped parking lot, okay? There's an area in the back of the post office where it looks like there's a loading zone. There's also parking spaces back there. Then there's parking, if you're facing the front of the post office, there's parking spaces to the left. So the fact that these statutes may apply just by the fact of the definition of highway, you'd have to take into consideration that very few people or anyone who parks in that parking lot could abide by those statutes. Everybody who parks there is essentially going to violate the statute that would just apply by letter of the law, as opposed to the practicality of assessing a negligence in that particular area location.
So, from that, are you saying that you probably wouldn't have a finding instruction that identifies the horseshoe lane as a highway, or you would?
I would. That's what I would try to move into evidence. That's what we would have tried to move into evidence.
Well, then how would you handle the standard of care that is typically associated with, for lack of a better expression, a normal highway?
Well, there is a heightened, we would focus on it being a standard of the reasonable person standard. Because even in Brown versus Arthur, where it talks about if you're traversing between intersections, there's a heightened standard of care. It still establishes that it's a reasonable person under the circumstances, and circumstances is the operative word here. Circumstances, the fact that it's primary use is a parking lot, the fact that the way the parking lot is configured, the fact that the sidewalk that the appellees argue should have been used is in the front of the parking lot and not close to any of the parking spaces. There was a mentioning that the most direct route would be to go into the front of the post office, but in order to do that, the most direct route would be technically to go across the grass. If you notice where the parking spaces are. Now, the testimony of the parties in this case, including the witness Mr. Sykes, indicates that it's commonplace for people to use that side entrance.
Counsel, may I ask a question about a couple of words in the statute that I'm not exactly sure what it means. In the 100 code section, and for law enforcement purposes of the statute. Generally, you will see that, for example, with DUI statutes when they're trying to distinguish private driveways from highways. This places the width of the post office parking lot after the qualifier that's for law enforcement purposes. What does that mean?
Well, for law enforcement purposes, the way we interpreted it at the time, mm-hmm. Your Honor, I mean Justice, is that that it was because the location was property of the United States government, it did fall into the just by letter of the law, the statute, because there is vehicular travel, but law enforcement particular would likely be for the purposes of handing out citations for violation of a statute.
Okay. Thank you.
So maybe the statute really has no effect at all on tort duties vis-a-vis passengers getting out of vehicles and walking to the side entrance. Maybe it's limited only to the necessary ownership and authority predicates for federal law enforcement.
Potentially so, Your Justice, that is correct. Going further with the proximate cause, the main argument here is that with proximate cause, this even if you are going to apply the statute and argue that Arletha Sims was negligent, we are not conceding negligence, but even if you, for the sake of arguendo that she is, proximate cause is still a question better kept for the jury. The way she parked her car, once she got out of her vehicle, the rightmost portion of the parking lot, or if you want to call it a roadway, would be against the rear of the parked vehicles to her left. If she traverses traverses the backside of those vehicles, she puts herself in more danger, number one, of being hit by a vehicle backing out. Number two, she still has to cross over to that side entrance. So at one point, she's still going to be in the middle of the roadway. Thus, Mr. Van Son, who backed up 15 to 20 feet, it's a possibility that he still could have made contact with Ms. Sims and caused the injury. That is consistent with the facts in Rasher v. Friend, because you have a bike rider who's going through an intersection. The defendant makes a left turn. At the time she makes the left turn, he looks down at his watch. As a result of that, the accident happens. At trial court, the trial court found that he was contributory negligent because he didn't keep a proper lookout by looking down at his watch. But on appeal, the reasoning was overturned, and the reasoning is that the accident could have possibly happened anyway. And so even if you're going to attribute negligence on the part of Arletha Sims, this incident could still have occurred. Following Spear versus Kellum, this is a case where the plaintiff decedent was hit and killed by the defendant while he was walking on a road with his back toward oncoming traffic. And the court stated that violation of code section amounts to negligence as a matter of law, whether or not such violation be a remote cause or the cause which proximately contributes to the injury is a question for the jury. And even in Brown, the appellee cite on a number of occasions, the instruction properly told the jury that if a pedestrian crosses a street diagonally, that is in violation of the terms of the statute. It constitutes negligence. It also properly left to their determination whether such negligence, if any, proximately contributes to the happening of the accident. And at the end of in summation, the jury should have had an opportunity to consider all the facts and circumstances in this case, apply the law using their common sense and their life experience, and make a determination. Now, would that have come out in favor of Arletha Sims? It's not. I think it would have, but we're not sure. But the bottom line is, it should have been a question for the jury. Moving on to the actual negligence, the contributory negligence, we're not conceding that. We have to look at her conduct before she was hit. Before getting out of her vehicle, she gathered her umbrella and checked the rearview mirrors to make sure that there were no cars coming from the rear. Once she exited her vehicle, she walked to the back of her vehicle and stopped. She then looked to see if any cars were coming or backing out in the parking lot. While waiting to see if it was safe to move towards the post office entrance, she observed parked vehicles to determine whether the engines were running and the lights were on or the windshield wipers were in operation. None of the vehicles exhibited these indicators, so she felt it was safe to proceed. She also saw Mr. Van Son in his vehicle looking down at his lap. As she attempted to walk from her car to the post office entrance, she remained careful and cautious, looking for vehicles that were coming toward her or backing out. And in that moment where she did not look, the vehicle backed out and hit her with the rear of its vehicle. And in Lubowecki versus Donald, a pedestrian who undertakes to cross the street between intersections is required to exercise a greater degree of vigilance than is required when crossing at an intersection. In determining whether the pedestrian has met this standard, the test is whether he exercised such vigilance as a reasonably prudent person would have exercised under the circumstances. Now, first of all, there's no intersections here for her to even cross between. And we've already been over the fact that there's no sidewalk, there's no shoulder. And applying these statutes is very difficult based on the location of the incident. But even if you do, based on what the standard is, she exhibited what a reasonably prudent person would have exercised under the circumstances. Thus, there is an issue as to whether she was negligent, and that should have been a jury question. Now, the appellees cite a number of cases that to support the fact that she was negligent. Now, in summation, Sims was not walking across a busy roadway on a dark, rainy night. She did not get hit by a vehicle that was driving down the road with its headlights activated. Unlike the plaintiff in Brown, Sims did not see the vehicle moving and get hit because she misjudged its speed. She took every precaution to make sure her path was safe and continued to look for cars after she walked past Mr. Vanson's vehicle. Thank you.
All right. You have 38 seconds remaining.
May it please the court. My name is Clint Verity, and I represent the defendant in this matter, John Van Son. The trial court correctly sustained defendant's motion to strike on the basis that plaintiff was contributorily negligent as a matter of law because she was walking down the middle of a roadway with her back turned to cars that she admits she knew may be backing up. There's three bases for why she's negligent as a matter of law. The first is she failed to use reasonable care when crossing a road in between intersections. In this court's decision of Brown versus Arthur, it states that both a driver and a pedestrian must use reasonable care when passing between intersections. And a reasonable care for a pedestrian in between intersections is greater vigilance than one at an intersection.
Describe the intersection here.
There wouldn't be one until the roadway reaches South Main Street. So there would have been an intersection of the roadway that goes around the Emporia parking lot as it reaches the South Main Street.
Right, and she was not hit in an intersection.
Correct. Okay. And so the law, as I'm citing, Your Honor, is when crossing in between intersections or not at an intersection, which I would submit is the law
of this case. So your position is this horseshoe driveway, the two intersections or the two portions of the driveway that are coming off of Main Street are the intersections referred to in the code section?
Yes. And she is choosing to pass in between intersections.
How is this for law enforcement purposes that turns this parking lot into a highway?
Well, the highway definition, I would point out, in the beginning says the entire width and boundary of everywhere place for use of public purposes of vehicular travel in the Commonwealth, including streets and alleys, and for law enforcement. So first, I would argue that the first part of that definition certainly applies to this roadway that goes around the Emporia Post Office. But to answer your question,
but if that were true, then every parking lot that has, like Walmart, with all the lanes, there's vehicular traffic going on. You're saying every parking lot in the Commonwealth is a highway?
For purposes of that definition, I certainly believe that where there is a roadway where someone is going down that's designed for vehicular traffic, yes. So it would depend on the setup of the parking lot. If it is a parking lot where you have a roadway that is mainly traveled, I would submit to the court that that is a roadway within the parking lot. Conversely, if it's just a lane between a number of parking spots, you know, like a typical parking lot where it's wide open, you have lane, then maybe not. But
nobody travels around this horseshoe just to travel. They travel to park, unless you're sightseeing.
Well, they certainly
don't know if you're sightseeing in the back of the post office in Emporia.
No, you're not.
It's certainly not sightseeing, but it is a road that is used to come in and out of the post office, whether you park in one of the parking spots or not. So I still believe it's a roadway. It's a one-way road that goes around the building.
But all of that begs the following question. Why would this case be any different than a pedestrian being hit in one of those lanes at Walmart? Is there any difference in the legal principles that ought to be applied?
Well, I do think to the extent the two statutory duties that I cite with regard to crossing at right angles and staying to the left or the right side of the roadway, it certainly has an applicability there, but the general duty of crossing a roadway and using as a pedestrian and having a duty of reasonable care that is heightened because you're not doing so at a intersection would not be affected by whether such
But you're suggesting that in a commercial parking lot, that it may very well be a roadway for your purposes. Well, if that's the case, where are the intersections? I mean, you're looking for crosswalks? I don't see them in commercial parking lots.
Well, first I'll point out this isn't a private parking lot, but nevertheless, it would depend on the setup. It would depend on how the parking lot was
designed.
Well,
I know it's not a private parking lot, but the question is, are they treated the same? That's the purpose of the question. I'm listening to your argument, and I'm wondering why the law is any different in a public way a right-of-way or a roadway or whatever you want to call it, because you seem to equate the two. If you're equating the two, why are the legal principles any different?
Well, I'm equating them to the extent that there is a roadway. So you have the roadway that goes around the post office, which you can then park off to the side or use the loading dock or do a number of other things that vehicles would do traversing this roadway. If it were a private parking lot and there was a roadway where you had an entrance off the main road that then went through a number of areas where you had availability to park and then exited back onto a public highway, I would say that's a roadway.
The problem with that is that you're putting private in those first three lines of 46-2-100, and it doesn't distinguish between private and public within the code section. And so then we would have to interpret this as to whether, as the Chief Justice said, does this apply to Walmart and Target as well as this post office, or does it not apply to any of them because it's talking about I-95 and Highway 58?
Well, I don't think the court has to make the determination of whether it is a public versus a private. Whether the legislature intended to make it both on public and private, because here we're talking about a public roadway owned by the federal government. And that being the case, the question then becomes, is this fit within that definition of every way in place?
Let me ask you something. What would your answer with this whole thing about Walmart parking lots be, I don't know, and it doesn't matter for my case?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And that's what I was trying to say, as politely as I could, that we're not dealing with that, and it's not a decision that has to be made because it's not before the court.
But the way you get out of the for law enforcement purposes section, I think, I heard you earlier, is to go to the very first sentence of that paragraph.
Well,
and the first sentence of the paragraph, under your interpretation, would include Walmart, whereas, of course, the subsection little 2, the U.S. government roads, would not. So if you take off your main hook, which is the government owns this, the federal government owns this, so it's a highway. You take that off because that's limited for law enforcement purposes, not for tort purposes. Then the only thing you're left with is your first sentence, and that first sentence is broader than the federal government. Am I misunderstanding you?
Well, somewhat, because I never got to the second half, which I would say law enforcement purposes for purposes of this is, do the rules of the road apply?
Law enforcement? In a statute, when it says for law enforcement purposes, it means some tort case? Enforcing tort law?
Well, this definitional section applies to when it's read in conjunction with the two statutes that I cited, which is VA Code 46.2928 and 46.2923. Those do regard duties for tort liability and whether somebody's negligent as a matter of law. So I think I would submit to the court respectfully that if you read it in conjunction with the rest of it's a definitional statute that applies to the rest of this chapter, that for law enforcement purposes would include rules of the road to be all-encompassing.
Right, my last question, I promise. But the paragraph has an opening sentence, right, that says roads, generally, for public use. And then it goes on to, for law enforcement purposes, some other things, including the federal government post office roads or whatever. Why would they have to do that for law enforcement purposes if the first sentence included everything, a fortiori law enforcement purposes, and all roads, including post office roads?
I'm not sure the intent of why they would draft it that way. However, I do think the first area, the first section of it, is all-encompassing with regard to public and private, and here we have public. And to the extent it wouldn't be, I would argue that the law enforcement's broad enough.
Is it possible that this entire argument with regard to the code sections, that these code sections don't apply because this, for law enforcement purposes, takes all of these statutes off the table for purposes of this post office parking lot? But I guess my question is, can we get to that because no assignment of error was raised, that this can't be contributory negligence as a matter of law? The assignment of error was never raised that these don't apply. Both the lawyers and the judge treated it as if it did. And
I would argue if the assignment of error is not in there, the court couldn't consider it. There's one other issue that I'd like to address is that even if it didn't, what it comes back to is the common law standard of reasonable care when crossing the parking lot. And under the case of Hodgkin versus McCall, is directly on point. And there, we're not talking about any statutory duties. There, it's the common law, pedestrian versus a car. And the pedestrian was crossing a roadway. She got halfway across to the median, saw vehicles coming from, or checked to the north to see if vehicles were coming, saw that they weren't. Then turned her back and faced south, waiting to see if those vehicles were going to clear. While she was facing south, and it turned her her back to north, a car came from the north and struck her from behind. And the court found that they upheld the trial court's ruling that she was negligent as a matter of law, and that it was approximate cause of the accident as a matter of law. And here we have the same thing. We have a lady who knew that vehicles would be pulling out of a parking spot. She turned her back to that vehicle. She admitted at court that she knew that vehicle could possibly back up and it would be. She turned her back to that vehicle. She was in the center of the roadway and she was struck by that vehicle because she didn't see it coming. And under the case, the court stated in Carson versus Meredith as to the common law duty when crossing in between intersections, is the pedestrian looks for approaching vehicles as she's crossing the street. She's presumed to have seen what she should have observed and been careful and attentive. She cannot justify her conduct by saying that she looked and did not see approaching vehicles that injured her when, if she had looked, she would have seen the vehicle. Under that case, you have somebody who turned their back to traffic they knew would be coming. That's exactly what we have in this case. And the court stated that negligence is a matter of law under common law without even getting into what the statutory duties were and the definition of a highway. And under that case, she was negligent as a matter of law. And then also with regard to the proximate cause issue, because I think that's an important one as well, is that the court enunciated that where the plaintiff has the equal opportunity to avoid the accident as the defendant, it's approximate cause as a matter of law. And here, you have essentially analogous facts where had she looked at the vehicles that she admitted she knew could be backing up, she could have avoided the accident as a matter of law. So under that case,
The testimony was that she actually looked at all the vehicles, including Van Son's vehicle. I mean, she knew that he was in his car looking down his lap.
Well, she gets to the back of her vehicle and stops, is her testimony. She looks to the left. She sees Mr. Van Son's vehicle. He is in it. She then walks down the center of the roadway and is struck. and she didn't see the vehicle before she was struck. So the last time she looked at it was she was at the back of it, in front of it, and then she continued across the roadway and never looked again and got struck. And she has a continuing duty as she crosses the road to act as a reasonable person would and to look for vehicles that she knew would be potentially backing up. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Rebuttal?
Briefly, Hodgins v. McCall, a case cited by the appellee. The plaintiff attempted to cross a busy street between intersections on a dark, rainy night, standing in the center lane of the most traveled area in that location on a rainy night. She turned her back to traffic. In this case, the vehicles were moving. And Ms. Sims walked across a parking lot, looked at vehicles that were stationary, continued to look for vehicles as she testified, but in the moment she did not look behind her, that's when Mr. Van Sun pulled out and struck her. I would say that it is quite distinguishable from the Hodgson call is quite distinguishable from the facts of this case.
All right, thank you very much. Call the next case.